This is Alonzo Bowden. I want to welcome you to episode 348 of my podcast, Who's Paying Attention? And today is going to be a very special episode. My guest today, this guy, changed comedy. I don't think I'm exaggerating in saying that. He is a comedian. He is an actor. He is a writer. And now he is an executive producer. The world famous Guy T, Guy Tori, and his documentary on Fat Tuesday on Amazon Prime. You have to watch this documentary to see how he changed comedy, not just black comedy. You changed comedy in L.A. You had the biggest show in Los Angeles for how many years?
Man, well, first of all, thanks for having me, Alonzo. And I would like to correct you a little bit and say we changed comedy.
Okay, thank you. But that's
we
you being...
We changed
and
comedy.
They
no,
talk about
real.
This in the documentary about your humility. And when I say you did it, obviously all the comedians
yes.
in the show and the whole thing, but you were... You started it. You were the driving force. It was Guy Tori's Fat Tuesday, and then it became Fat Tuesday, right?
Right. It was Fat Tuesday. Then it became Guy Tori's Fat Tuesday. Okay. Somebody said, you got to brand it and make it your own. Because, you know, I didn't know much when I started it.
Right.
I was doing comedy 3 years, you know. I'd never ran a business before, you know. And I didn't have that many credits under my belt. I had, you know, a few. But it's just something that needed to be done. I think it was probably the most important comedy night in the history of comedy because of what it turned into and what it was. And it's funny because I think back, people are often say, you know, what made you start it? And it's funny how when you're kids and your parents are always saying something to you, you don't realize it's sticking.
Right.
And I remember being a kid and my dad was military, drill sergeant, you know, by the book. And he was always like, take initiative, don't wait to be asked, be told something. If you see something need done, go ahead and do it. You see it hanging on the floor, don't pick it up. I mean, don't walk over it, pick it up, even if you didn't put it there. Put it where it belongs. And I heard that time and time again as a kid, and then flipped to 1992. You know, I moved to L.A. to do stand-up. I'm at the Comedy Act Theater, which is in South Central L.A., mm-hmm. the spot where all the Hollywood agents would come and see, you know, black comedians, the place the stars would come and see black comedians. And then, boom, Robin Harris dies, and then the Rodney King riots happen, and industry isn't down there anymore. So by the time 95 came, I said, you know, I saw a void and was like, don't walk over it. No, don't wait for somebody to tell you to start a comedy night. Just freaking started comedy night, and that's how Fat Tuesday started.
So let's talk a little. Let's back up a little, because you mentioned a name that's very important in black comedy, and a lot of people don't know this name or don't know the impact of Robin Harris.
Yeah, man.
Robin Harris is a guy, when people ask me, like, who influenced you, because, I tell people, I didn't grow up wanting to be a comic. It came about,
yeah.
You know? But Robin Harris was amazing, and people are like, who? Who? To me, Robin Harris, that was the quickest mind I had ever seen. Like, he was on top anything, bam, he hit it. And Robin, he influenced comedy. And so talk a little about that.
So wait a minute, first of all, you got to see him live, which I didn't get a chance
to see. This was the funny thing. I saw Robin live before I was a comic.
Wow.
And I made the mistake of showing up late.
You felt the wrath that I've heard about.
So to my audience, if you in any way called attention to yourself at the Comedy Act Theater, show up late, stand up to go to the bathroom, spill a drink, anything
right,
else,
right.
Robin would snap his fingers and they'd put the spotlight on you. And Robin would tear you apart. So that night, my name was Otis. I was instructed to sit my big ass down.
Did you have a high top fade back then?
Yeah. Thank God I didn't have a Jerry curl.
Yeah, man. No, I used to hear stories about Robin Harris from my brother Joe Torre. For those who don't know, I have an older brother named Joe Torre who does stand up first. He moved to L.A. first. And I remember being in St. Louis, man, going to see Luther Vandross at the Fabulous Fox Theater, right? And Louis Dix was opening for Louis Dix, comedian who went on to open for Bill Cosby. I don't know if it was pre-Pill Bill or during Bill Cosby Pill days or whatever, but Louis Dix, very funny comedian, used to open up for him. And they announced that Robin Harris was coming to the Fox, this comedian that I think he had done a couple of movies by then. And I called my brother Joe and said, oh, man, I'm going to get tickets to see this Robin Harris guy. He said, no, that's my friend. I'll get you tickets. I said, you sure? He said, yeah, that's my friend. I'll get you tickets. About 3 weeks later, my brother calls me, and I'm like, yo, did you get those Robert Harris tickets? He said, nah, man, he died. I said, come on, man. If you can't get the tickets, just say you can't get the tickets. Don't wish death on the dude. And then my brother's voice started cracking, and he said, no, he died last night. And
I was tragic.
Like, oh, man. Tragic. So all the stories I heard about Robert Harris, man, came from my brother and came from, you know, later on. We'll probably get into that later on, but I won't ruin it now. But, yeah, it came from just people being around. And then going to the Common Act Theater, doing stand-up myself, all the people who were around Robin, I would hear those stories. Ricky Harris had a whole bunch of stories, too. Yeah. Rest in peace, comedian Ricky Harris.
So now, moving on, and again, I'm trying to educate my audience as we go about comedy. So one of the big differences between black and white comedy, and I don't like that division, but there are cultural divisions within comedy.
Sometimes.
Right. Sometimes, right? Yeah. But one of the things is that in the black comedy world, the host is a star. The host is a star of the show, and he brings up the guests. You did that, but you did it in such a way that you made the comics, literally some of them stars, literally some of them became stars from Fat Tuesdays, but you never, like, how do I say it? Your name was on the room, but I don't think you consciously worked to dominate it or at any point was worried. You know, sometimes you get the host, they're worried about someone else being too funny, or they gotta, like, if somebody kills, they gotta cut them somehow or something like that. Whereas with you, it was more of a generosity, like, wow, look at this. Like, this show is better because he killed and she killed. And
that's why I started The Room. I started The Room for two reasons. One, to showcase black comedians that weren't getting a shot, because I already had an agent and manager and stuff. And I saw so much talent being, you know, overlooked. But two, I wanted a spot to work out on a regular basis. So hosting, you know, it gives you that stage time. But I take notes out of every president, well, most of every president. It's the president surrounds himself by people who are smarter than him to make him look good. I surround myself with people who are funnier than me because I want the whole show to be great. You know, it's like my job is just to be the conductor and keep the show moving. And if you weren't ready, because, and I know rooms. I don't know if you ever did that creative tour back in the day and Club 559.
No, I didn't do that.
Club 559 was a club in Atlanta. It was in Bankhead, the bad part of Atlanta, Bruce's room.
Okay.
And it's one of those clubs where if they check you for a gun at the door, and if you don't have one, they will give you one. I mean, I'm telling you, this room was gutter. And I heard that they would boo you. Like, and the host was kind of like, welcome there.
Yeah, encourage that. Yeah.
You know, and that's like, I'm a fan of comedy. I don't want to see anybody bomb. Now, when they do, it's funny as hell.
Oh, we love it.
There's comics I don't like. I don't want to see bomb. But that's just the way, you know, I was raised, you know, personally, is to give back and to help other people out.
At what point did you realize what it was?
I realized it was something special when I started doing the documentary.
Really?
I'm serious.
So not until you looked back on it.
Not until I looked back.
Did you realize? Because this was you.
And it was important.
You started in 95, so I was a rookie.
Started The Room in 95.
The Room.
I started stand up in 92.
Yeah, no, I meant The Room. Yes. I meant the show. Fat Tuesday started in 95, so I was a rookie then. I started in 93, so I did Fat Tuesday a couple of times, but I was like, I was just that. Like, I was a rookie, come in, do a few minutes. If I didn't get killed, I felt good about myself. You know, that's just how it is at that point in your career. I will say, I do remember because, you know, my comedy, obviously more mainstream, news driven and stuff like that. And I remember Cedric telling me, keep doing you.
Yeah.
Because you know, it was like I didn't fit
the Def
the
Jam
stereotype
mode.
Of
Def
perfect,
Comedy
perfect
Jam
description.
Mode.
I wasn't a Def Jam guy.
Right.
Like, and I tell everyone, I'm from St. Albans, Queens. We didn't know it was the hood till 50 Cent mentioned it. We were like, we thought it was just a working class black neighborhood.
See,
we didn't even know.
Well, people don't know, we lived in Jamaica, Queens, before St. Louis.
Uh-huh. I didn't know that. I never knew that.
Yeah, born in Northern California, Army brat. Mom and dad split up because dad had PTSD from Vietnam. So she took six kids from Northern California, put us on Continental Trailways, and we all went to New York, Jamaica, Queens, because her mom lived in New York.
Okay.
She didn't like how we were growing up in New York, because we were fighting, you know, blacks and Puerto Ricans all the damn time. So we ended up moving to St. Louis. So I claimed St. Louis because I was there from age 7 to 23.
Okay.
But I spent a few years in Jamaica, Queens.
Right.
On Woodhall Avenue.
So my point, talking about me and comedy, like right. I was a young buck, I was learning. And it was great that I got encouraged like that because you feel on the outside.
Right.
But I also knew I couldn't do Def Jam because that wouldn't be real. Like and in one thing in comedy, you got to tell the truth. Unless you're 100% committed to playing a character, you got to tell the truth. So at this time, that room was obviously the big time. But it's so funny to me that you didn't know. Like you were literally, not only were you watching people become stars, you became a star.
Well, you know, at the time, man, I was busy, meaning that I was still acting. I was still touring as a comedian. And then some of those years I was doing morning radio in St. Louis from L.A. 5 days a week. So I was getting up at 2 a.m. So it was and running Fat Tuesdays, producing it. It was all out of my pocket, hosting it. I finally hired somebody to book it because I just didn't have time. And I thought it'd be a conflict of interest. And so I had all these other things going on. And then within that, too, I ended up getting married. That's a whole nother job. So I had all this going on at the same time. I'm fighting with my agents and my managers because they thought I should be focused on me and giving too much love to the comedians. So it was a lot of chaos going on back then. So I didn't realize it was Michael Blackston who actually was on a flight with me one day. We were going to Sacramento for different shows. And he said, man, I miss Fat Tuesdays. This is about 13, 14 years ago. He said, I miss Fat Tuesdays, man. These young comics need to know, you know, what Fat Tuesdays is. And that's when the light bulb went off, like, huh, I love documentaries. Let me see what I got. So I dug in the archives, see what I had. I had some footage. So I started asking people, man. Like, I had this young director who was coming up, Bishop Moore, who was an aspiring director. So I said, yo, man, I want to start doing these interviews, put a presentation together, a sizzle together to go shop. Mm-hmm. This documentary. And so, and when we started getting interviews, man, the stories start coming out of how much it meant to so-and-so and what they booked off of that. And they were able to buy a house for being a hostess at Fat Tuesdays. They may have been good with cash register, too. I don't know, but I didn't pay them that much. But anyway, no. But they all these stories start coming out, man, and I was like, wow, this is something special.
Oh, it absolutely was and is something special. And I don't want to give away too much of it in this interview, but you did talk about your work ethic. Did that come from your dad or 'cause you were about business? You were working all the time and never on just one thing. Where did that come from?
That came from mom and pops, man. It came from two things. Mom and pops were workaholics. Dad was a guy who retired from the military, you know, went and started working at the post office in St. Louis. No, started driving school bus first, you know, then retired, got bored. 2 weeks later, went back to work at the post office, worked there for years, retired, got bored in 2 weeks, went back to the post office to work, worked there for another post office for years, retired, 2 or 3 weeks, got bored, started working at the church as a custodian for free because he just wanted to be busy.
Right,
Mom was always busy too, busybody. So the work ethic comes from there, but the work ethic also comes from being, you know, my insecurities. And I'm all about prep. So, you know, yes, we are comedians. We have great improv skills and things like that. But I like to have a skeleton, too. I like to have, you know, a skeleton to help put the meat on the bones or have a direction or a map. I may stray off the map, but I want to be ready. So the prep is very important to me and just getting those reps in.
So, yeah. So you were doing that. Let me ask you this, though. Did you get to enjoy it, the Hollywood side of Fat Tuesday? Because I don't even know for how many years it was like, okay, the Lakers are hanging out here. Everybody on TV, everybody in a movie was any and everybody in LA would come through. I know everybody was like, you know, don't you know who I am? Because there was a line down the block, right? Yeah. And every brother wants to, you want to be able to get to the front of the line. Walk your girl to the front of the line.
Right.
And, you know, we realize that you did a Nike commercial, but that might not be enough to get you to the front of the line.
I got a couple of stories. Let me answer the first one. Let me answer the first question.
Did you enjoy it? Did you get
I enjoyed nights of it because there's sometimes some of Luke dancers from, Two Live Crew would be in there. The after party was at my one bedroom apartment back then. So those a couple of nights I did it. If I didn't have an audition in the morning,
oh,
a
I got
flight.
A story that relates directly to you about that. But go ahead.
And the other one story was so there's one night I had a really great staff. I had beautiful women who were strong, smart, and no nonsense women. As the front of the house managers, basically.
Which the documentary highlights that.
Right. And so it was one night, and I'm going to say his name because he's a cool guy. He probably laughs at it today. One night we was in there, and it was packed, jam-packed. Like, couldn't fit nobody else in. The fire marshal was there and said, if you put one more person in, I'm shutting this room down. So actor comes in. He's on a hot show, right? Hot show was Grey's Anatomy.
Mm-hmm.
This is like toward the end of that first season. He was hotter than slave ass, man. He was hot. So he comes in, and he's just by himself. And he said, yo, I want to get in. And my manager, the manager, she goes, I'm sorry, it's your capacity. I can't let you in. He's like, well, what do you mean? He said, fire marshal's here. If I let one more person in, they're going to shut us down. I can't do guys' business like that. He's like, well, you know who I am? She said, I know exactly who you are. I'm a big fan. I loved you in Soul Food. I love the new show, but I can't let you in. And that doesn't happen in this town
with
women and big-name celebrities that they have crushes on. They're like, oh, and jeopardize my whole operation.
Yeah.
So yeah, that happened so many times. And there's some other names that remain nameless because they really got, you know,
hot
with my front staff, and some of them were NBA champions. Now I'm doing commentary now on Ford Network. But that's how my staff was,
no
man.
Names.
That's how they were. They were very stern and very serious about the business.
But that's perfect. That's what you need, especially in this town. You know, and the people listening, I don't know if you really understand the egos and the levels.
Ooh.
You know, when they talk about an A-list star, a B, and it's like – no, they're keeping score as to who I am and who's in front of me in line.
Yes.
Like I always say, like if you go to a Laker game when the Lakers are, you know, hot.
Yeah.
You
saying
know,
that because he's a Clipper fan. I've seen him at several Clipper
games.
That's
right. I'm
go
a
ahead,
big
sir.
Clipper fan. Absolutely. But you know where you stand based on where you sit at a Laker game.
Right.
And everyone's there. No one's watching the game. They
no
want to see who else is there and where's he how's he sitting in front of me? What the?
Yeah. Look. If you look at Laker games now, and I've seen more NBA teams do this, they turn the lights down on the audience because of that reason.
Right.
Because they want the attention and the focus on the floor,
game.
On the game. But they used to be all lit up, and people would, you're right, people would be the looky-loos, like at a tennis match, seeing who's there. And so now more teams are adopting that philosophy. It's like, you know, it's not about the audience and who's there, it's about the product on the court. So that's funny.
I'm going to tell you this story. I may have told you this story. I may have thanked you for it. If I haven't, I will thank you right now. You used to have the show in Guam.
Oh, yeah.
Right? You used to book Guam. So I go to Guam for you. And to my audience, Guam is an island, beautiful island in the South Pacific. There's an Air Force base on one end, a naval base on the other, a Walmart, and 200 strip clubs. That's Guam.
You're leaving out a very key point.
Go ahead.
At about 9,000 stray dogs.
Yes.
I don't know where. I mean, they run in packs.
They've been breeding on the island. There's no predators.
Right.
So they
man.
Just...
and it's kind of so, America, but it's not. It's kind of like the illegitimate child of America. It's like the child across town that your family don't know about.
It's branded as America, so anything made in those factories, they can label made in USA.
Yes.
That's what they do.
Yes.
So I go there, and I think I got there maybe on a Thursday or something. The show Saturday. I don't remember. But I jokingly said, so where are the dancing girls? And the dude was like, they'll be here Saturday, and because this was at the time of the Fly Girls on Living Color.
Right.
So you actually had, like, so anyway, there's a pre-show party.
Yeah.
This stripper grabbed me, and she looked at the promoter, and she said, when does he have to be back? And he said,
you
oh, the show is
that.
Saturday. Man, she took me club to club with all her friends. I never forget, she had a Crown Royal bag full of dollar bills. And she's taking me club to club, all of her friends. I'm getting free dances, all this and that.
What?
Takes me back to her room, right? Total freak night. Then the next morning, she gave me $20 and called a cab. And I was like, I feel cheap.
What? Well, that's never happened to me in Guam, in Hawaii, in Atlanta, nowhere.
It was one of those crazy experiences that you just have once in a while. You're like, did that just happen?
Man, I've had some wild stories.
No, you're welcome. Thank you for your
I'm like Magic going down court pointing at you. That's a nice assist.
That was it. That was the assist. But it was also... It was also that time in comedy. And you talk about this in the documentary. You know, hip-hop and comedy with Def Jam. Mm. And Def Jam was on TV and you were live.
Def Comedy Jam.
But this is what was happening where it had this superstar element to
right.
it that was changing. Like comedy had been, you know, comedy clubs
right.
and this and that. There had been funny
people. Especially for
blacks. Right, and for black people, and you talked about this, there was always one black comic that was, he
right.
was the star of the moment. Then there was the next one. But now, multiple people are becoming stars.
Right.
In your room, you know, Chris Tucker is becoming a star. Yes. And like I said, you.
Cat Williams started to blow up.
Cat
Nick
Williams,
Cannon.
It's all of these comics that were
Mike
making
Epps.
Names for themselves in the 90s. Cedric. And, you know, all of these comics were there. Did you feel that vibe? Did you feel this is something like how were the comics with each other? Was there a competitiveness? Was it a camaraderie? What was the feeling? Because as you said, industry was walking in.
Right.
And they were like, wow,
yeah.
look at this talent pool that
yeah.
was right down the street that we never knew about because we were afraid to cross the 10.
Going north
right?
of Wilshire,
they
yeah.
were, to those who don't know L.A. geography, if you go south, okay, from Hollywood, like you say, when you hit Wilshire,
yeah.
you get nervous. When you
yeah.
hit the 10 freeway, you stop.
Yeah.
The other side of the 10 used to be South Central. It's all gentrified
yeah,
now.
Yeah, it's called South L.A. now with white girls in Lululemon pants walking Yorkies and holding a Starbucks in their hand.
But was everybody, you know, because like I said, my experience with it was they were generous to me as a rookie coming up. Was that the general vibe or was there a competitiveness to get in front of the industry?
I don't think it was as competitive as it is now. And I think that also goes to the room, the energy of the room. Because of different clubs, it meant different things. And I'm going to take it back a little bit. What really made me another chip on my shoulder that I had that really kind of start Fat Tuesdays. When I first got to L.A., and white people would ask me, oh, you're a comedian, what can I see at the Comedy Store, Laugh Factory, or, you know, the Improv? And I couldn't tell them.
Right.
Because I wasn't a regular in those clubs. And it made me feel like I was not a real comedian if I was not at the big three. Improv, Comedy Store, Laugh Factory. And I hated that feeling. But then we also had black comedians, a few, who were regulars in those clubs, the Improv, the Laugh Factory, and the Comedy Store. And they would come south of Wilshire to the black neighborhood, to the black comedy spots. And you'd ask them, yo, you going up? And they stick their chest out like, no, I got a spot at the store tonight.
Right.
I got a spot at Laugh Factory tonight. And like, just come down to rub it in our faces that they're regulars at those rooms on Sunset, those clubs on Sunset, and we weren't. And I hated that feeling. They were peacocking. So when I brought Fat Tuesdays to the Comedy Store, I was hoping that they would be happy.
Mm-hmm.
Some of those black comedians were pissed off that
really?
I was bringing.
Some of them resented it.
Some of them tried to get Mitzi Shore, who owns the Comedy Act Theater, rest in peace, and Pauly Shore's
Comedy
mom
Store.
And the Shore family. They tried to get Mitzi not to do Fat Tuesdays.
Really?
These
so
black comics.
It was that crab in a bucket
yes,
mentality.
Because usually when you black, you can do some white, can I cuss? Some white shit. You want to be the only one.
Yeah.
And you want to walk around in peacock like, yeah, you know, you almost like Django. But who's
what you
that
doing
nigga
on that
nag? So you kind of want to be the only one, you know, in Massa's house.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's a shame, but I was like, nah, we all coming. We all coming
yeah.
up on Sunset.
And you know, this was a thing.
It's like that scene in a Straight Outta Compton video when they bust through when they bust through the paper.
Yeah.
That's what it was. That's how we bust through the Comedy Store doors.
So doing that, how much percentage of the white audience, because this was another thing that happened in the 90s, white people loved black comedy.
Absolutely.
Just like hip hop. Like when they saw black people doing black comedy, they were like, wow.
I'm going to push back on that a little bit.
How much? Okay, I'll listen to your pushback, but I want to ask how much of the audience were white people who wanted to see black comedy?
White people have always loved black comedy. Mm-hmm. When I was researching for this project, I took it all the way back to slavery. And slaves used to tell jokes to master to keep from getting their ass whooped.
Oh, yeah.
And if they were funny enough, master would take them to another plantation to perform for another slave owner.
Oh, that.
So they always loved our brand of humor.
Yeah, that's true. No, I'm not saying that they didn't love it.
Got it. Okay.
I'm saying that it became accessible to them.
Got it.
You know what
Got
I mean?
It.
Like,
that
I've always
sense.
Said, like, when I first moved here, right, and you go to Roscoe's, right? You go to Roscoe's Chicken and Waffles. If you're in L.A.,
I just
iconic.
Passed a brand new one. They got on Washington and La Brea, brand new.
Right, because I think they closed the one on Pico.
Oh, they closed Pico.
They closed Pico
okay.
and put the new. But I always said, why doesn't he open one in Studio City? Right, because white people would love chicken
yes.
and waffles and greens, but they ain't going to the hood
they
to get it.
They ain't going to the hood to get it. You're right.
So when I say they loved it, that's what I mean. You made it accessible because they were nervous about going, like you said, Comedy Act Theater, especially after Rodney King
right.
riots. But they'll go to the comedy store.
Right. And that's what was important.
So that's what I'm talking about. Maybe I wasn't
yeah.
clear in my question.
Right.
How many of them, now they can openly enjoy it
right.
and it's safe.
It was maybe 1% of the people mm-hmm. who came was white. And they were industry.
Yeah.
And it was one white dude who worked, I think he worked with Death Row, but you don't really count him as white because he was, you know, because he was.
Well, he was like Honest John.
He was more black than Honest John. He's way more black than Honest John. But then the other thing is, too, is Suge Knight would always come. Mm-hmm. Like, first time I met Suge Knight was he came with Tupac when mm-hmm. Tupac got out of jail. I met Tupac prior, and he loved comedy. Tupac was always giving me advice, always in my ear, telling me to get out my brother's shadow and create my own lane. But when some industry heard that Suge was a frequent customer or frequent in the audience there, they stopped coming.
They got nervous.
Because back then, 95, 96, if Sugar was around, there's some shit about to go down.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
it actually did scare some industry away.
He had
away.
A unique way of negotiating contracts.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, it was the Five Heartbeats, Big Red negotiating, hold you over a balcony.
Oh, I had a friend who built a motorcycle for him, and I was like, are you out of your mind? Like, luckily he got paid, but then Sugar broke the bike and he fixed the bike. A second time, it was like, nah, man, I'm taking it, you know.
Wow. See, here's the thing about that. It's good to be naive sometimes. Because
mm-hmm.
I had no – I knew the name Suge Knight.
Right.
And this is 95, and I'm from St. Louis.
Mm-hmm.
I knew the name. I never knew what he looked like. So when he came to Fat Tuesdays, I was letting him have it.
Yeah.
And I think he thought that I was just, you know, had balls and didn't give him, you know, F. So I remember years later – I think one of the radio stations, K-Day, wanted to do a Suge Knight roast, and my ex-wife worked at the station at the time. I said, I want to host it. She's like, you crazy? You going to host a Suge Knight? Yeah, I ain't scared of Suge. I mean, I was, but I wasn't going to let them know. But yeah, sometimes when you're naive, man, it's better. And I think that's what made Fat Tuesdays happen. If I knew then what I know now, I probably wouldn't have done Fat Tuesdays.
Right,
as far
you didn't
as, like,
know you weren't supposed to do it.
Exactly. Exactly. That part.
You didn't know you 3 years in, you are not supposed to be at the comedy store hosting a show.
Right.
And bringing all these
with
stars
no money,
in. Right.
No social media. No advertising budget. Nothing. Just will and ambition
and talent.
Pay it forward.
And talent.
Talent.
And you know, I will say the naivete probably helped you because you didn't know enough to be scared.
Right. That part.
Right? You didn't know enough to be scared.
Right.
Which I remember early in my career, the same thing happening. Like when I did New Faces in Montreal, I didn't know enough to be afraid of it.
Right.
You know, it was
right.
like, oh, because I did two different sets, right? You had to do 7 minutes. And they were like, wow. And I'm thinking, yeah, I got 14 minutes.
Yeah.
Like, that's just, you
yeah.
know.
And we really didn't. Now I think we overthink sometimes. Mm-hmm. Is this the right set? Will it appeal to the audience there, the television audience, and the industry? Rather than just going on stage and doing your damn 7 minutes. But that's how I met Bob Saget. Uh-huh. I met Bob Saget at the Aspen Comedy Festival. Mm-hmm. And I was with New Faces back then. And we were in a group with John Alston out of the Bay Area. It was Billy D. Washington, I mm-hmm. believe. And it was Billy Gardell, man Billy Gardell. We were all young. Billy. And I believe Ruben Paul was in our group mm-hmm. too. And we were just like, man, instead of competing against each other, let's root for each other.
Yeah.
So we'd get together and help work on each other's sets. And then I'd gather everybody in. We'd say a prayer before each set, before each show. And boom, we're just rooting. We're the loudest laughers in the room, you know, while our buddies on stage in our group. And I met Bob Saget that weekend, man, and he heard about Fat Tuesdays and was like, he wanted to come down there. And I didn't see his stand-up at that point. I knew he was from Full House, mm-hmm. but I didn't see his stand-up. And I'm
so
like,
you didn't know.
I'm like, you sure? I'm like, to myself, I'm like, you sure you want to play this black-ass room? It's a lot of N-words in that movie. And so I said, all right. And then Billy Gardell, was I did see his stand-up. Mm-hmm. And I knew that Billy Gardell could do Fat Tuesdays still being himself. Mm-hmm. I hate when white comedians come on stage and try to black it up.
Right.
And Billy Gardell was not that guy.
And that's what I'm talking about when it's false, because the audience reads false.
I hate when black comedians go in white audiences and try to white mm-hmm. it up. Just be yourself.
Yeah.
And so I met Bob Saget that weekend, man, Billy Gardell that weekend. And it's funny because I interviewed him for the presentation reel to sell this. He's in it. I wanted him for this one too. And he was just like, man, you don't understand what Fat Tuesdays did for me. And he said, I hear a lot of comics tell me, oh, I live in L.A., I got a comedy night, come on through. He said, I get there, I call them, and they don't return my call. So you're the first person who returned my call and put me up at Fat Tuesdays. And he said, the money you paid me was enough for me to put some gas in my car, buy a couple of beers and some food in my belly to get me over to the next week. And, I mean, those things right there is when it made me say, man, this night was special for those stories and people to remember that. And Billy Gardell would come in town and just rip Gary Owen. Mm-hmm. You know, black rooms was not letting Gary Owen on stage. And I'm like, you know, because he's a white boy, but he was killing.
He's killing.
I'm like, absolutely. Man, I know you can play a black room. So mm-hmm. so come on. And same thing with Flame Monroe. You know, transgender. I was putting transgender comics on stage before it was a thing.
Well, this comes up in the documentary. And again, to my audience, you have to watch this documentary on Amazon Prime about Fat Tuesday. But everyone talked about that, how you gave everyone a shot, black, white, transgender.
You had to be
wasn't
funny
even
in
a
white,
thing.
Though.
Transgender wasn't even a thing.
Right.
Like, nobody even knew there was a word for that.
Right.
You know
right.
what I mean?
We just called it cross-dressing back then.
Right. There wasn't even a word.
We didn't.
For it.
We was ignorant back then, but now we're educated.
Women, which was a big thing, and I'm with you on that. That when you hear the women aren't funny, Wanda Sykes told me one time. Someone said to her, to Wanda Sykes, they said, "You're funny for a woman."
Oh, man. That's so offensive, man. Because growing up and being my age that I am, I'm 53 years old. So growing up in high school, I was here, you cute to be dark.
Yeah.
From women when you actually say that. I mean, they didn't know how ignorant they sounded at the time. And I'm like, well, what's that supposed to mean? Like, you're cute to be dark. Like, it's a mentality that we have. Women ain't funny. That's bullshit.
Yeah, women aren't funny. They're hilarious.
I'm telling you something. Yes, they are.
They're stars.
And I used to be on a Def Comedy Jam tour, man, and I would watch, you know, people like Yvette Wilson and Angela Means and Adele Givens, man, be on stage killing. And the audience would give it up.
Yeah.
But they should have been giving up even more because these women were freaking hilarious.
Right. So, two things. I want to get back to the I don't even know if it's a naive question. But before that, we talked about social media for a minute. Do you think today Fat Tuesdays could happen in this era of social media? And what I mean by that is people cut loose at Fat Tuesdays. People had a good time. They talk about it in the documentary.
Yes.
Today, everyone got a camera and a phone. They can't wait to tell TMZ that so-and-so was seen with so, you know, this and that. Do you think the same party vibe could happen today, especially with the celebrities who, you know, people listening, one of the things about being a celebrity is you're aware people recognize you, right? Like, yes. Like we used to joke when we did Last Comic Standing back in the day, we're like, man, I can't rent porn anymore. I'm on NBC, man. Right, they gonna recognize you. You can't go in the back of the video store.
Right, now you're a creep.
Right, now they isn't that so?
So-and-so? Yeah, you're right.
Do you think that would do you think the atmosphere could be the same today in the and I hate to say it, but it's a gotcha world. It's so much of that.
I think what it is because you do still have like chocolate sundaes at the Laugh Factory on Sunset, which was one of the children's of Fat Tuesdays. You have Mo Better Mondays, which is now D. Ray Mondays, and celebrities still come out to those events. I think what has happened with in regards to the celebrity part is that they know they have to move different, and that's what I tell people. When you have to move different, when it's in any situation you're in, even if you're not a celebrity. If you're of color, if you're a woman in certain places, you got to move different when you know the consequences if you don't, if you aren't aware, and if you're reckless. Mm-hmm. You have to move different. So it can still happen. And, you know, I mean, and you know, I don't think at a comic club they would do what they do at a Chappelle show or Chris Rock show or Kevin Hart show where they take your phone and lock it up.
Uh-huh.
I mean, that can become expensive for a comic club and you know, a hassle. But I think it can be done, but the celebrities just have to move different. And that's it. You have to adapt. You have to change and be aware of your surroundings. But yeah, a lot of stuff went on back then, bro.
Yeah, yeah. Like
a lot, man. Man, if there were camera phones back then.
Right, right.
But the flip side of that is it's more free promotions.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Absolutely. Take the good with the bad.
Yeah.
Because now you got people posting, oh, man, I saw, you know, Jay-Z in the audience last night at Fat Tuesdays or Better Mondays.
Right.
So now somebody who's like, oh, I'm going to go to, I can pretend.
Yeah, now you know it's a spot.
Yeah, exactly.
Now you got to get
either
there.
Dudes want to come because they love Jay-Z, or women want to come because they know, hey, maybe I can get a baby out of Jay-Z. or one of the cronies, you know?
Yeah, someone close to it. I could be Jay-Z adjacent.
Yeah, yeah, exactly right. I love when I look at those apartments. When you look at the apartments, when I first moved out here, it's like Beverly Hills adjacent.
Yeah.
It wouldn't be, it's not Beverly Hills, but it's Beverly Hills adjacent.
You can see Beverly Hills.
Yeah, you can see. You can see a palm tree from the top of your roof.
Okay, I want to shift gears now because Fat Tuesday, everyone listening is going to watch a doc.
Yes.
And it was phenomenal.
Yes.
Now I want to talk about your career because there's one thing in particular. You are a great actor, okay, and I admire that. But you did a movie no one at the time expected. When you did American History X.
Oh, that one.
Not only did this movie was heavy, you're working with Ed Norton. Like, this is an A-list Hollywood movie. This isn't a movie you do on the way up. This was it. Was it intimidating walking in? Because again, everyone knows you as a comic, and back then I think you were still going by the world famous Guy T.
World famous Guy T.
Yeah.
They didn't know me past Crenshaw, but I was the world famous Guy T. They didn't know me on the other side of Wilshire.
But you was world famous Guy T. So was that experience intimidating to walk into that?
No.
That's great.
Because I was naive.
Talk about that.
Is that being naive? I didn't know I was acting across from an Academy Award nominee actor in Ed Norton. You know, it came from Fat Tuesdays.
Right, right.
They came to see someone else at Fat Tuesdays. I went up. They offered me the role. I didn't know what it was. And I got invited to a table read. I thought it was like, you know, you've been in this business long enough to where, oh, we're going to do a table read, see how the script flow. It's not even picked up or greenlit or anything.
Right.
I thought it was one of those. And so I go to the table read. Ed Norton is there, and Stacey Keach is there, and Barbara DeAngelis is there, and the director's there. And I'm reading three different parts because I was, you know, only a black guy in the room. So I was reading three different parts, and the character I end up playing. And then I just didn't think anything of it. You know, about a month later or so, maybe shorter than that, I'm at the YMCA on Sepulveda playing basketball. Pick up basketball, we go play on Tuesdays and Thursdays and stuff. So I get a text to call my agent. And they're like, oh, hey, you booked that movie Two Brothers. Because that was the original name. Yeah. It was called Two Brothers first. It wasn't American History X. I was like, oh, okay. And then I end up booking a pilot. Like, I went to the Aspen mm-hmm. County Festival.
Yeah.
I booked a pilot, Good News, which was on UPN, which was created by one of the greatest TV producers of all time, Ed Weinberger, who mm-hmm. created Taxi, yeah. Mary Tyler Moore, Cosby Show, Amen, Sparks, Sparks, and Sparks, and Good News. And, man, I remember doing the pilot and rapping at like 2 in the morning, rapping the set. We finished the pilot at 2 in the morning, and I had to be on set for American History X at 6 a.m. And I hadn't seen Primal Fear before I did American History X. That's the only movie Ed mm-hmm. Norton had done. But I can recognize that he has some chops, some right. acting
this
chops.
This is his thing, yeah.
And then after, and that's how just God planned it, man, because after I wrapped the movie, I went and watched Primal Fear and was like, oh my God, this dude is a beast. I had no idea, but that's again, man, being naive and just my, because I didn't really study acting, you know.
Really?
No.
Really?
I started studying after that.
Well, yeah, but I mean, but because that was dramatic. I mean, you were, the character in the movie, like I could see that being you. I could see you learning that just living.
Right.
But what people don't, this is the part of acting that people don't understand. You didn't do that once. It was take two, take three, take five, and you have to come up with that same emotion, that same level of intensity. And I always tell people, that's the difficult part of acting you don't see. And this isn't even doing it wrong. It's like, well, we got to shoot it from this angle, then we got to shoot it from that angle.
The lighting messed up, the camera guy messed up.
Whatever. But you hadn't studied acting,
no.
and you were still able to do that. That says a lot. That's phenomenal.
No, but I think here two things to that. One, our acting classes are usually on stage, right? I mean, there's a lot of actors. I mean, comedians who can't act.
Yeah.
But the ones who are usually vulnerable and transparent on stage, and just real and no gimmicks, you know, they're going to be a good actor, right? Number two. Comedians, we're very dark, twisted, fucked up individuals.
Absolutely.
On the inside. And what happens is, if we could learn to put our comedy ego out the way when we're playing dramatic parts, then we'll be great dramatic actors. But we're so trained to find the funny with that muscle. But you have to take that whole comedy thing and throw it away. Otherwise, you won't play that character honestly, that dark character. You got to go to that dark side that we are, that we always trying to hide when we're on stage. Mm-hmm. So if you look at comedians who have done dramatic work, man, they've taken that ego and learned to put it to the side. Kevin Hart, the most recent one, who, and I knew that, we did a movie together called The Last Stand, mm-hmm. and he plays this comedian who has a meltdown with the puppet. And I was like, man, if Kevin ever decides to do drama, he gonna kill that shit. But it's that part. So and with me and my role in American History X, you know, God guided, but it was just me playing a role honestly. And they wanted me to bring some comic relief to it.
I'm gonna speak to that from personal experience because I was studying acting and I had a great acting coach, and her specialty was taking people from one genre to another. Like, she famously coached Meat Loaf for Fight Club.
Oh, wow.
You know, she was that. And she saw me do stand-up, and she said, go do that. She said, you are so, like, your passion, your whole mm-hmm. thing is so into that. She said, if you wanted to be an actor, you could, but I can just see where you want to be. She said, go do that, which was cool. I get it,
right.
You know. And I love that. I have no regrets. I joke about acting and stuff like that. But getting back to you, so now you do American History X. You do this dramatic, heavy piece. And for people who haven't seen the movie, it deals with race and white supremacy and prison. It's very real. It's a drama.
Yeah, it's real.
Then you go to prison again with the funniest people in the world.
Oh.
Now, what's that like doing life? And now you're working with Eddie Murphy, Martin Lawrence, just everybody,
Bernie Mac,
everybody was in that movie. Now you get to do you. Right?
Yeah. Well, yes and no, mm-hmm. Because I auditioned for it, got it. And it was like, man, I'm in a movie with Eddie Murphy and Martin.
Right, there's no naive now. You know who they are.
I know, man. Yes. Well, especially Martin, because I worked on a Martin show,
right,
as a PA.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then I wrote an episode of Martin, and I also guest starred in an episode of Martin. So, and Martin was, you know, was like family friend.
Yeah.
I mean, him and Joe were friends. My brother Joe mm-hmm. were friends with Martin, and that's how I got the job as a production assistant on the Martin show. But anyway, it was one of those situations in the movie life where you have these giants, right? These guys who inspired you to do stand-up in the first mm-hmm. place. And a talented surrounding, supporting cast. Oba Babatunde, Chewbacca Henley, and Brent Jennings, and Miguel Nunez, and Barry Mockatello-Ferro, rest in peace. And I mean, it was those guys, and it's like, hell, you know, I gotta fit in without trying to overact and without trying to compete. So it's finding your lane within this group of other talented actors. And then also was a period piece.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't really be yourself because I didn't live in that period.
Right.
But I did go study that period. I looked at a bunch of movies from the 40s and this is how the black people was talking. I learned the different dialects mm-hmm. in that of that era, the different slang, right, in that era, and what they did physically. Because, and I'm glad I did that, because on the first day of the set, Eddie made it comfortable for all of us because he told the director, let them go. Let them do what they feel like they need to do to make this their character pop. And we have that freedom from one of the greatest comedic actors and actors in stand-up of our generation, Eddie Murphy. That's like, wow, he trusts me. Well, so all that studying the different lingo and different, even the handshakes
right.
were different back then. You got, if you're going to ad-lib, you better ad-lib on,
within
in period.
Within the context of that period.
Within that
right.
period. So that's why I was like, fun, but at the same time, you still had to be focused.
Yeah, but also, and maybe they were the outtakes or whatever, but there had to be moments that, because I've been in those. We've all been in those. This is what people want to see with comics, when we start laughing with each other.
Yes.
Because now it goes to a level, like you said, yeah. when you're in that room and something happens funny and you guys start tagging it and going, did we get to see any of that in the movie? The because I know it had to go,
let me tell you,
to insane
man.
Levels.
A lot of those ad libs came, weren't in the script.
Right.
Bernie Mac for one.
Oh, absolutely.
Eddie Murphy, yeah. Martin Lawrence. I mean, that scene where we're at the table when they're asking what you in for, we must have done 30 takes because every take Eddie had a different take and it was funnier than the other take. There was no dud takes. And that's why when you look at the movie, it's a jump cut because they just took.
Right, they took the.
And then Bernie Mac, I don't think Bernie Mac had lines in that scene.
Mm-hmm.
They just put the camera on for his reaction and he made up all that. I said, that's what the beat say. All that was just ad lib. And the meet a pappy scene, you know, I'm the pappy.
Yeah.
That was supposed to be a serious scene, but Bernie kept stepping out every time. I'm like, and dude, we just took. They just kept it in as a scene where we all laughed. But man, to have that type of freedom, and that with that type of cast, man, is like a dream come true. I still pinch myself, and it's so funny too because Eddie Murphy used to frequent Fat Tuesdays as well. Mm-hmm. But I still see Eddie Murphy to this day. I'm still starstruck.
Yeah, well, he's that.
You know,
he's that. He's like. There aren't many people who are that, right? Denzel is that.
Yes.
You know, it's like, yeah, you're in a category of one.
Yeah.
There's nobody.
Magic Johnson, man. Magic
right.
Johnson used to come to Fat Tuesdays and say, man, I love your comedy. I'm a fan of your comedy. I'm like, dude, I'm a Laker fan because of you. Growing
right.
up in St. Louis, and I saw you play at Michigan State and then go to the Lakers, I've been a fan. So now, never in a million years, I thought I'll be doing a comedy night where you're coming. And not only coming, you're scouting talent himself because he was managing comedians.
Right.
He came to
mm-hmm.
see Gary Owen.
Yeah.
Then, and he ended up asking me to do his Midsummer Nights. Mm-hmm. He had the big charity
right,
event
big
during the
game.
Weekend.
Yeah, that was.
He wanted to do a comedy show, and mm-hmm. the budget wasn't right for the comedians that he wanted. So I said, let's do a roast.
Mm-hmm.
And he listened. And we ended up doing a big roast. And this is after he had the HIV. So,
yeah.
You know, I had to put that roast together very strategically because we didn't want anybody to be disrespectful.
Right, right.
You know what I'm saying? So. That night was just special, man. That Fat Tuesday night was just special.
I want to get into you and what you're doing today, but before that, I want to ask you this. With everything you've done, do you have a favorite? Do you have a favorite role you played, a favorite movie you did, or a or one of those nights at Fat Tuesdays when, you know, like you say, Magic or somebody was there.
My favorite role would be I'd play a thong, Beyonce's thong. That would be a great role.
There's a long line for that one.
Yeah. Rihanna's thong. I like be Rihanna's belly button right now. Talking to the baby that's inside that I'm jealous that it's not my baby. No, man, I think I would say one of the most special nights there at Fat Tuesdays wasn't when I got American History X. It wasn't when I booked other jobs and stuff. But I think when Richard Pryor came.
Mm-hmm.
And Richard Pryor's in the audience. A few times he came. And it's like, wow, he came out to this night. And he's the reason why a lot of us do this, and you know, or try to get better at it. Like, he didn't inspire me to do stand-up. It was Def Jam. But once I got into stand-up and started studying stand-up, that's when I was like, oh, he made it look way easier than it was.
What's it like for Richard Pryor to tell you you're funny?
Dude, it's like you're being knighted, you know, because his words to me was like, you're funny, don't change.
Yeah.
But I think he told about 1,000 other comics the same damn thing, too. But still, to have him even know that you exist.
Right.
And then to speak to you. It's like, well, Eddie Murphy was the same way. Like, we were shooting the movie Life, and I go on set the next morning on a Wednesday, and Eddie be like, man, I heard you tore into a motherfucker's ass last night, boy. I'm like, he wasn't even there. I'm like, how did news travel that fast?
Yeah.
This wasn't even social media.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is 98.
Right.
This ain't even when he can look it up and saw it. It's just like somebody told him, oh, man, how Fat Tuesdays was the night before. Less than probably 12 hours earlier.
All right. So now let's move to today, because you came in, got here a little late.
I did, man.
And you told me why you were late and blew my mind. So tell my audience why you were a little late today and what you're about to do work-wise.
Yeah, I hate being late, especially being late to press. I think it's disrespectful. But I was late because I had to go pick up a jacket I special ordered. And when I got there, it wasn't ready. So I had to wait on them to find the jacket. Then when they found the jacket, I had to get here. But I needed the jacket because I'm flying out tomorrow to go do some gigs in Toledo, Ohio at the Funny Bone. I'll be there at Perrysburg. You know, if you're listening to this, you're from Detroit or Toledo, that area, come check me out, the Funny Bone. And I'm leaving out, and I'm going straight from Toledo to Vegas because on Monday I'm presenting at the American Country Music Awards, the one in Vegas.
Okay, say that one more time because I have a question for you.
The Country Awards, man, and because it's an Amazon thing, and this is one of Fat Tuesdays, the era of hip-hop comedy, is one of Amazon's new favorite pieces, along with the show Reacher.
Right. It's phenomenal. But here's the thing. This is that question when you go back in time, all right? So now I'm talking to, 20-year-old Guy T when you came to L.A.?
I got my T fixed, 23.
The year before. Okay, so no, I'm going to talk to 21-year-old Guy Tori, because you're not even world famous yet.
Right.
You Guy Tori in Chicago. And I'm going to say, yo, man, you might want to get ready because you're going to be. St. Louis. You might want to get ready because you're going to be presenting at the American Country Music Awards. What does that kid say?
Man, get the hell out of here. You know, it's like, whatever.
Yeah.
You know, but yeah, man, I'm like, this is great. I'm looking forward to it. I'm excited about it, man.
Oh, it's going to be great. And, you know, Mickey Guyton, she sang at the Super Bowl.
I was there.
And a phenomenal voice.
Yeah.
But she sings country music.
Yeah.
That's when both sides are like, wait, what?
Yeah.
When, you know, black people are like, wait, what? And white people are like, wait, what?
Yeah.
And she killed it, obviously.
Charlie Pride came to Fat Tuesdays one time.
That's fantastic.
Music, black, those you don't know, Charlie Pride played in the Negro baseball leagues, but he also was a country musician.
Yeah.
And he was black. He won the few. And for years and years and years, a lot of people didn't know he was black because it was like, this is back in the day.
Right. They wouldn't, because before video,
right,
they wouldn't let you see.
Right.
Just like the opposite thing with Tina Marie,
right,
where they were like, no, don't put a picture on that
right
album. Just let her sing. Because nobody knew, for the first record, nobody knew she was white.
Right, and he came to Fat Tuesdays. At first, he was shocked that I knew he played in the Negro Leagues because I was, you know, messing with him from the stage. And I told him that he was the Eminem of country music. Because at the time, that's the Eminem.
Right.
Was killing rap, the black rap game.
Right, and people were like, who? What?
Yeah.
Wait a minute.
Yeah.
You know? And you know,
I'll be presenting at the Country Music Awards.
There's gonna be a few people in that audience,
man. I'm gonna look like a Hershey Kiss and a bowl of sugar.
They're gonna be able to find you.
Yeah. So that's why I was late, because I was picking up, you know, red carpet. You got to be fly, but you got to keep it you too.
Right.
You can't try to, like we said earlier, with stand up. I can't go try to be country.
No, if you show up wearing an American flag jacket, people are like, wait, what?
Yeah.
You know who?
Yeah, that's not gonna fly. And the cowboy hat that's turned up. Like, I wear hats, I wear Liz, but I don't do the turned up.
Yeah, you got the flat brim.
Yeah.
And it looks good, by the way.
Thank you, man.
I love that. I love people who can wear hats. I do not have a hat head.
A lot of people say that until they wear a hat numerous times. Nah, you
wearing a hat.
Off.
No, man.
You look like Karl Malone in it.
We have a friend in common who I will bring up. We talked about this before, who's a true hat guy, Marcus Miller.
Oh.
Marcus Miller, good friend of mine, bassist, composer, musical genius, and he did the music for the documentary.
I was going to tell that story.
And the pork pie hat, he always says, it wasn't until Breaking Bad. Like, in Wikipedia, it used to be him.
Really?
It was his picture with the pork pie hat. He was so known for it. Then Heisenberg started wearing one, and they were like, well, Marcus, we got to bump you.
Move over. This whole thing about Marcus Miller, man, I worked at a music store in St. Louis, and I shared this with you already. And I'm a big lover of jazz music. So I should see his name on the back of CDs, David Sanborn, Keith Robinson, the musician Keith Robinson, not the very funny comedian Keith Robinson. But Marcus Miller, Marcus Miller, Marcus Miller, Marcus Miller. Who would have known that all these years later I would be doing a project and Marcus Miller scored the project? That's like those seeds being planted earlier in your life.
And you don't know it.
And you don't know it. And I'm like, I almost got emotional when we were on the Zoom call and Reggie Hudlin, the great director, did a phenomenal job, him and his team, with this documentary, directing it and co-producing it. Shout out to Kelsey Grammer as well, man, who really believed in the project. Gramnet really came through. Original Productions, the other production company that with us, Jeff Hasler, but also, you know, Jordan McMahon and Tom Russo. I got to shout out the whole crew, man, Byron Phillips, because it took a village to put this production on. And we just found out the other day that it's Time Magazine's top 5 new shows to watch.
Absolutely.
So, you know, they want to cross-promote this at the Music Awards in Vegas. So tune in. You'll see my little black ass next to
Reacher.
Yeah, Jack Reacher, basically.
Yeah.
Basically. And we're going to look like Donkey and Shrek. But, you know, it's going to be a good time.
It's going to be phenomenal.
I got a call I got to do. I'm sorry.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, you good.
You good?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, give me 5 more minutes of your time.
I'm going to tell him right now. I'm late all day today. Let me tell the... It's a call about Fat Tuesdays, too.
Yeah, absolutely. You're hot right now, man. You're hot.
It's what you said earlier when you opened the show. What's next?
Right.
And this is what this call is about.
So is there a project or projects you can tell us about that you're working on, that you're developing, coming up?
When I originally pitched this, people told me that documentaries don't make money. And documentaries, it's going to be a tough sell. So I created other shows, scripted and unscripted, you know, attached to it so that, boom, you do this, you get first refusal on these other ones.
Right.
So there's a scripted idea that's being talked about. There's a live component to it that's being talked about. And the Fat Tuesdays brand is just going to get fatter.
Well, I'm looking forward to it. We're looking forward to it. You know, if you need a bouncer on screen, I'm your guy.
Yeah,
you know that.
Yeah. We're going to get you back in those acting shots.
Door man.
We're going to bring you back to your mark. Get on your mark. And I want to say, before we wrap up, Ontario Improv, I'm there next weekend, which is April 10th and 12th. 10th through the 12th, I'll be at the,
If you're in Southern California, go see Guy T at the Ontario Improv. Right. I'm going to have you back on. We're going to talk about current events because that's normally what the podcast is about. But before you go, I am going to ask you this. Okay, we've got pandemic, we've got a war, we've got the Senate hearings are starting with Ketanji Brown Jackson, and we know there's going to be a lot of nonsense and bad blood and whatever else is going to happen there. I'm asking the world famous Guy T to give us a little bit of good news. Give us some.
I'll give you the good news is that now lynching is now becoming.
Yes, it is illegal.
It's illegal now in 2022. And three Republican senators voted against
it. Right, still fought it.
Yeah.
Still fought it.
But lynching is now a hate crime and a federal crime and. It's illegal.
It's ridiculous that we're laughing about that, but trust me, the listeners understand why we're laughing, the ridiculousness of it. And yeah, it's like, oh man, lynching. Yeah, they got around.
Yeah.
They finally got around to that.
We forgot about that. Wow.
Man, I got mad respect for you and love and what you've done. And I'm happy. This is what I'm happy about. You enjoy it now. Like, you may not have realized it then,
right.
But the fact that you're enjoying it now, a lot of times people who create something, because you created a legacy. This is a legacy you have with Fat Tuesday. And a lot of times people don't get to enjoy that in their lifetime. They don't know what they did.
Right.
So I want to say I'm honestly very happy for you and happy that you get to enjoy what you did.
I appreciate
it. And I know you say we did, and I understand the we part of it. But all of us, you know, pay tribute to you. And we get that it was Guy Tori's Fat Tuesday. Everybody was there. Everybody. And there was a lot of people wasn't there lying about being there. Oh, man, I knew Guy Tori in 91.
Right. I used to go there. I got a few of those. Like, I didn't start to 92. It didn't start to 95. But yeah,
man, I did Fat Tuesday in 83.
Right. I was in eighth grade in 83, freshman in high school, I believe. Yeah, I was.
Thank you, man. Thank you.
And I would love to come back anytime, man.
Absolutely.
For real.
Anytime. Absolutely.
And I'll be on time. I was like, this call, they call me now. Here you go. Are you coming? Yes, I am. Are you joining our 4 p.m. call? Yes.
This is Alonzo Bowden. The podcast is Who's Paying Attention. I will be in Philadelphia this weekend at Helium Comedy Club. Thank you guys for listening. Once again, Guy T, thank you for being here.
Thank you, man.
Subscribe to Amazon Prime, even if it's just to watch this, even if you just do a month.
Right.
And watch Fat Tuesday.
They get Prime. They get delivery. So
yeah,
they
get you get
Prime
delivery.
Anyway.
You get
and please follow
delivery.
Me on social media at Guy Tori, GUYTORRY.
All right. Thank you, brother.